armies larger when he wrote that book of his, so as to make his conquest that much more glorious, and it has pleased us to water the seed he planted, and let our foes think us more powerful than we are. But a princess ought to know the truth. Valor is a poor substitute for numbers. Dawn cannot hope to win a war against the Iron Throne, not alone. And yet that may well be what you have given us. Are you proud? The prince did not allow her time to answer. What am I to do with you, Arianne? Forgive me, part of her wanted to say, but his words had cut her too deeply. Why? Do what you always do. Do nothing. You make it difficult for a man to swallow his anger. Best stop swallowing. You like to choke on it. The prince did not answer. Tell me how you knew my plans. I am the Prince of Dawn. Men seek my favor. Someone told. You knew, and yet you still allowed us to make off with Myrcella. Why? That was my mistake, and it has proved a grievous one. You are my daughter, Arianne. The little girl who used to run to me when she skinned her knee. I found it hard to believe that you would conspire against me. I had to learn the truth. Now you have. I want to know who informed on me. I would as well in your place. Will you tell me? I can think of no reason why I should. You think I cannot discover the truth on my own? You are welcome to try. Until such time, you must mistrust them all. And a little mistrust is a good thing in a princess. Prince Doran sighed. You disappoint me, Arianne, said the crow to the raven. You have been disappointing me for years, father. She had not meant to be so blunt with him, but the words came spilling out. There, now I have said it. I know. I am too meek and weak and cautious, too lenient to our enemies. Just now, though, you are in need of some of that leniency, it seems to me. You ought to be pleading for my forgiveness rather than seeking to provoke me further. I ask leniency only for my friends. How noble of you. What they did for love for me. They do not deserve to die on Gaston Grey. As it happens, I agree. Aside from Darkstar, your fellow plotters were no more than foolish children. Still, this was no harmless game of Sivas. You and your friends were playing at treason. I might have had their heads off. You might have, but you didn't. Dane, Dalt, Santagar? No, you would never dare make enemies of such houses. I dare more than you dream. But leave that for the nonce. Sir Andrey has been sent to Norvos to serve your lady mother for 3 years. Garin will spend his next 2 years in Tyrosh. From his kin, amongst the orphans, I took coin and hostages. Lady Silva received no punishment from me, but she was of an age to marry. Her father has shipped her to Greenstone to wed Lord Estamont. As for Aris Oakheart, he chose his own fate and met it bravely. A knight of the King's Guard. What did you do to him? I fucked him, father. You did command me to entertain our noble visitors, as I recall. His face grew flushed. Was that all that was required? I told him that once Myrcella was the queen, she would give us leave to marry. He wanted me for his wife. You did everything you could to stop him from dishonoring his vows, I am certain, her father said. It was her turn to flush. Her seduction of Sir Aris had required half a year. Though he claimed to have known other women before taking the white, she would never have known that from the way he acted. His caresses had been clumsy, his kisses nervous, and the first time they were abed together he spent his seed on her thigh as she was guiding him inside her with her hand. Worse, he had been consumed by shame. If she only had a dragon for every time he had whispered, "We should not be doing this. She would be richer than the Lannisters." Did he charge at Arya Hotar in hopes of saving me? Arianne wondered. Or did he do it to escape me, to wash out his dishonor with his life's blood? He did love me, she heard herself say. He died for me. If so, he may well be but the first of many. You and your cousins wanted war. You may get your wish. Another Kingsguard knight creeps towards Sunspear, even as we speak. Sir Balon Swan is bringing me the Mountain's Head. My bannermen have been delaying him to purchase me some time. The wiles kept him hunting and hawking for 8 days on the Boneway, and Lord Ironwood feasted him for a fortnight when he emerged from the mountains. At present he is at the Tor, where Lady Jourdain has arranged games in his honour. When he reaches Ghost Hill, he will find Lady Toland intent on outdoing her. Soon or late, however, Sir Balon must arrive at Sunspear, and when he does, he will expect to see Princess Myrcella and Sir Aris, his sworn brother. What shall we tell him, Ariane? Shall I say that Oakheart perished in a hunting accident, or from a tumble down some slippery steps? Perhaps Aris went swimming at the water gardens, slipped upon the marble, hit his head, and drowned. No, Ariane said. Say that he died defending his little princess. Tell Sir Balon that Darkstar tried to kill her, and Sir Aris stepped between them and saved her life. That was how the White Knights of the Kingsguard were supposed to die, giving up their own lives for those that they had sworn to protect. Sir Balon may be suspicious, as you were when the Lannisters killed your sister and her children, but he will have no proof until he speaks with Myrcella. Or must that brave child suffer a tragic accident as well? If so, it will mean war. No lie will save Dawn from the Queen's wrath if her daughter should perish whilst in my care. He needs me, Ariane realized. That's why he sent for me. I could tell Myrcella what to say, but why should I? A spasm of anger rippled across her father's face. I warn you, Ariane, I am out of patience. With me? That is so like him. For Lord Tywin and the Lannisters, you always had the forbearance of Balor the Blessed, but for your own blood? None. You mistake patience for forbearance. I have worked at the downfall of Tywin Lannister since the day they told me of Aelia and her children. It was my hope to strip him of all that he held most dear before I killed him, but it would seem his dwarf son has robbed me of that pleasure. I take some small solace in knowing that he died a cruel death at the hands of the monster that he himself begot. Be that as it may, Lord Tywin is howling down in hell, where thousands more will soon be joining him if your folly turns to war. Her father grimaced, as if the very word were painful to him. Is that what you want? The princess refused to be cowed. I want my cousins freed. I want my uncle avenged. I want my rights. Your rights. Dawn. You will have Dawn after I am dead. Are you so anxious to be rid of me? I should turn that question back on you, Father. You have been trying to rid yourself of me for years. That is not true. No? Shall we ask my brother? Tristan? Quentin? What of him? Where is he? He is with Lord Ironwood's host in the Boneway. You do lie well, Father, I will grant you that. You did not so much as blink. Quentin has gone to Lice. Where did you get that notion? A friend told me. She could have secrets, too. Your friend lied. You have my word, your brother has not gone to Lice. I swear it by Sun and Spear and Seven. Ariane could not be fooled so easily. Is it Mir, then? Tyrosh? I know he is somewhere across the narrow sea hiring sellswords to steal away my birthright. Her father's face darkened. This mistrust does you no honour, Ariane. Quentin should be the one conspiring against me. I sent him away when he was just a child, too young to understand the needs of Dawn. Anders Ironwood has been more a father to him than I have, yet your brother remains faithful and obedient. Why not? You favour him and always have. He looks like you, he thinks like you, and you mean to give him Dawn. Don't trouble to deny it. I read your letter. The words still burned as bright as fire in her memory. One day you will sit where I sit and rule all Dawn, you wrote to him. Tell me, Father, when did you decide to disinherit me? Was it the day that Quentin was born or the day that I was born? What did I ever do to make you hate me so? To her fury, there were tears in her eyes. I never hated you. Prince Doran's voice was parchment thin and full of grief. Ariane, You do not understand. Do you deny you wrote those words? No. That was when Quentin first went to Ironwood. I did intend for him to follow me, yes. I had other plans for you. Oh, yes, she said scornfully. Such plans. Giles Rosby, Blind Ben Beesbury, Greybeard Grandison. They were your plans. She gave him no chance to reply. I know it is my duty to provide an heir for Dawn. I have never been forgetful of that. I would have wed, and gladly. But the matches that you brought to me were insults. With every one, you spit on me. If you ever felt any love for me at all, why offer me to Walder Frey? Because I knew that you would spurn him. I had to be seen to try to find a consort for you once you'd reached a certain age, else it would have raised suspicions. But I dared not bring you any man you might accept. You were promised, Ariane. Promised? Ariane stared at him incredulously. What are you saying? Is this another lie? You never said. The pact was sealed in secret. I meant to tell you when you were old enough. When you came of age, I thought, but I am 23 for 7 years, a woman grown. I know. If I kept you ignorant too long, it was only to protect you. Ariane, your nature. To you, a secret was only a choice tale to whisper to Garin and Taïd in your bed of a night. Garin gossips, as only the orphans can. And Taïd keeps nothing from Obara and the Lady Nim. And if they knew, Obara is too fond of wine, and Nim is too close to the Fowler twins. And who might the Fowler twins confide in? I could not take the risk. She was lost, confounded. Promised. I was promised. Who is it? Who have I been betrothed to all these years? It makes no matter. He is dead. That left her more baffled than ever. The old ones are so frail. Was it a broken hip, a chill, the gout? It was a pot of molten gold. We princes make our careful plans, and the gods smash them all awry. Prince Doran made a weary gesture with a chafed red hand. Dawn will be yours. You have my word on that, if my word still has any meaning for you. Your brother Quentin has a harder road to walk. What road? Ariane regarded him suspiciously. What are you holding back? Seven save me, but I am sick of secrets. Tell me the rest, father, or else name Quentin your heir and send for Hotar and his axe and let me die beside my cousins. Do you truly believe I would harm my brother's children? Her father grimaced. Obara, Nim and Taïd lack for nothing but their freedom, and Ilaria and her daughters are happily ensconced at the water gardens. Doria stalks about, knocking oranges off the trees with her morning star, and Elia and Obella have become the terror of the pools. He sighed. It has not been so long since you were playing in those pools. You used to ride the shoulders of an older girl, a tall girl, with wispy yellow hair, Jane Fowler or her sister Jyn Allen. It had been years since Ariane had thought of that. Oh, and Frin, her father was a smith. Her hair was brown. Garin was my favorite, though. When I rode Garin, no one could defeat us, not even Nim and that green-haired Tyroshi girl. That green-haired girl was the Archon's daughter. I was to have sent you to Tyrosh in her place. You would have served the Archon as a cupbearer and met with your betrothed in secret, but your mother threatened to harm herself if I stole another of her children, and I could not do that to her. His tale grows ever stranger. Is that where Quentin's gone? To Tyrosh? To court the Archon's green-haired daughter? Her father plucked up a Saivas piece. I must know how you learned that Quentin was abroad. Your brother went with Cletus Ironwood, Maester Kedri, and three of Lord Ironwood's best young knights, on a long and perilous voyage, with an uncertain welcome at its end. He has gone to bring us back our heart's desire. She narrowed her eyes. What is our heart's desire? Vengeance. His voice was soft, as if he were afraid that someone might be listening. Justice. Prince Doran pressed the onyx dragon into her palm with his swollen, gouty fingers and whispered, Fire and blood.
Tyrion. The sow had a sweeter temper than some horses he had ridden. Patient and sure-footed, she accepted Tyrion with hardly a squeal when he clambered onto her back and remained motionless as he reached for shield and lance. Yet when he gathered up her reins and pressed his feet into her side, she moved at once. Her name was Pretty, short for Pretty Pig, and she had been trained to saddle and bridle since she was a piglet. The painted wooden armour clattered as Pretty trotted across the deck. Tyrion's armpits were prickly with perspiration, and a bead of sweat was trickling down his scar beneath the oversized, ill-fitting helm. Yet for one absurd moment, he felt almost like Jaime, riding out onto a tawny field with lance in hand, his golden armour flashing in the sun. When the laughter began, the dream dissolved. He was no champion, just a dwarf on a pig, clutching a stick, capering for the amusement of some restless, rum-soaked sailors in hopes of sweetening their mood. Somewhere down in hell, his father was seething, and Joffrey was chuckling. Tyrion could feel their cold, dead eyes watching this mama's farce, as avid as the crew of the Selassori Coran. And now here came his foe. Penny rode her big grey dog, her striped lance waving drunkenly as the beast bounded across the deck. Her shield and armour had been painted red, though the paint was chipped and fading. His own armour was blue. "Not mine, Groats. Never mine, I pray." Tyrion kicked at Pretty's haunches to speed her to a charge, as the sailors urged him on with hoots and shouts. Whether they were shouting encouragement or mocking him, he could not have said for certain, though he had a fair notion. "Why did I ever allow myself to be talked into this farce?" He knew the answer, though. For 12 days now, the ship had floated becalmed in the gulf of grief. The mood of the crew was ugly, and liked to turn uglier when their daily rum ration went dry. There were only so many hours a man could devote to mending sails, caulking leaks, and fishing. Jorah Mormont had heard them muttering about how dwarf luck had failed them. Whilst the ship's cook still gave Tyrion's head a rub from time to time, in hopes that it might stir a wind, the rest had taken to giving him venomous looks whenever he crossed their paths. Penny's lot was even worse, since the cook had put about the notion that squeezing a dwarf girl's breast might be just the thing to win their luck back. He had also started referring to Pretty Pig as Bacon, a jape that had seemed much funnier when Tyrion had made it.
"We have to make them laugh," Penny had said, pleading. "We have to make them like us. If we give them a show, it will help them forget. Please, my lord."
And somehow, somewise, some way, he had consented. It must have been the rum. The captain's wine had been the first thing to run out. You could get drunk much quicker on rum than on wine, Tyrion Lannister had discovered. So he found himself clad in Groat's painted wooden armour, astride Groat's sow, whilst Groat's sister instructed him in the finer points of the mummer's joust that had been their bread and salt. It had a certain delicious irony to it, considering that Tyrion had almost lost his head once by refusing to mount the dog for his nephew's twisted amusement. Yet somehow he found it difficult to appreciate the humour of it all from Sowback. Penny's lance descended just in time for its blunted point to brush his shoulder. His own lance wobbled as he brought it down and banged it noisily off a corner of her shield. She kept her seat. He lost his. But then he was supposed to. Easy as falling off a pig. Though falling off this particular pig was harder than it looked. Tyrion curled into a ball as he dropped, remembering his lesson. But even so, he hit the deck with a solid thump and bit his tongue so hard he tasted blood. He felt as if he were 12 again,
cartwheeling across the supper table in Castle Rock's great hall. Back then his uncle Geryon had been on hand to praise his efforts in place of surly sailors. Their laughter seemed sparse and strained compared to the great gales that had greeted Groat's and Penny's antics at Joffrey's wedding feast, and some hissed at him in anger.
"No, no, you ride the same way you look. Ugly!" one man shouted from the stern castle. "Must have no balls. That girl beat you."
"He wagered coin on me," Tyrion decided. He let the insult wash right over him. He had heard worse in his time. The wooden armour made rising awkward. He found himself flailing like a turtle on its back. That at least set a few of the sailors to laughing. "A shame I did not break my leg. That would have left them howling. And if they had been in that privy when I shot my father through the bowels, they might have laughed hard enough to shit their breeches right along with him. But anything to keep the bloody bastard sweet." Jorah Mormont finally took pity on Tyrion's struggles and pulled him to his feet.
"You looked a fool."
"That was the intent. It is hard to look a hero when you're mounted on a pig.
That must be why I stay off pigs."
Tyrion unbuckled his helm, twisted it off, and spat a gobbet of bloody pink phlegm over the side. "It feels as though I bit through half my tongue."
"Next time, bite harder," Sir Jorah shrugged. "Truth be told, I've seen worse justice."
"Was that praise? I fell off the bloody pig and bit my tongue. What could possibly be worse than that?
Getting a splinter through your eye and dying."
Penny had vaulted off her dog, a big grey brute called Crunch.
"The thing is not to joust well, Hugo."
She was always careful to call him Hugo, where anyone might hear.
"The thing is to make them laugh and throw coins."
"Poor payment for the blood and bruises," Tyrion thought, but he kept that to himself as well. "We failed at that as well. No one threw coins. Not a penny, not a groat."
"They will when we get better." Penny pulled off her helm. Mouse brown hair spilled down to her ears. Her eyes were brown too, beneath a heavy shelf of brow, her cheeks smooth and flushed. She pulled some acorns from a leather bag for Pretty Pig. The sow ate them from her hand, squealing happily. "When we perform for Queen Daenerys, the silver will rain down, you'll see."
Some of the sailors were shouting at them and slamming their heels against the deck, demanding another tilt. The ship's cook was the loudest, as always. Tyrion had learned to despise that man, even if he was the only half-decent Syvess player on the cog.
"You see, they liked us," Penny said, with a hopeful little smile. "Shall we go again, Hugo?"
He was on the point of refusing when a shout from one of the mates spared him the necessity. It was mid-morning, and the captain wanted the boats out again. The cog's huge striped sail hung limply from her mast, as it had for days, but he was hopeful that they could find a wind somewhere to the north. That meant rowing. The boats were small, however, and the cog was large. Towing it was hot, sweaty, exhausting work that left the hands blistered and the back aching and accomplished nothing. The crew hated it. Tyrion could not blame them.
"The widow should have put us on a galley," he muttered sourly. "If someone could help me out of these bloody planks, I would be grateful. I think I may have a splinter through my crutch."
Mormont did the duty, albeit with poor grace. Penny collected her dog and pig and led them both below.
"You might want to tell your lady to keep her door closed and barred when she's inside," Sir Jorah said, as he was undoing the buckles on the straps that joined the wooden breastplate to the backplate. "I'm hearing too much talk about ribs and hams and bacon."
"That pig is half her livelihood."
"A Giscari crew would eat the dog as well."
Mormont pulled the breastplate and backplate apart.
"Just tell her."
"As you wish."
His tunic was soaked with sweat and clinging to his chest. Tyrion plucked at it, wishing for a bit of breeze. The wooden armour was as hot and heavy as it was uncomfortable. Half of it looked to be old paint, layer on layer on layer of it, from 100 past repaintings. At Joffrey's wedding feast, he recalled, one rider had displayed the direwolf of Robb Stark, the other the arms and colours of Stannis Baratheon. "We will need both animals if we are to tilt for Queen Daenerys," he said. If the sailors took it in their heads to butcher Pretty Pig, neither he nor Penny could hope to stop them. But Ser Jorah's longsword might give them pause, at least. "Is that how you hope to keep your head, imp?" "Sir Imp, if you please. And yes, once Her Grace knows my true worth, she'll cherish me. I am a lovable little fellow, after all, and I know many useful things about my kin. But until such time, I'd best keep her amused. Keep her as you like. It won't wash out your crimes. Daenerys Targaryen is no silly trial to be diverted by japes and tumbles. She will deal with you justly." "Oh, I hope not." Tyrion studied Mormont with his mismatched eyes. "And how will she welcome you, this just queen? A warm embrace? A girlish titter? A headsman's axe?" He grinned at the knight's obvious discomfort. "Did you truly expect me to believe you were about the queen's business in that whorehouse, defending her from half a world away? Or could it be that you were running, that your dragon queen sent you from her side? But why would she—" "Oh, wait, you were spying on her." Tyrion made a clucking sound. "You hope to buy your way back into her favor by presenting her with me. An ill-considered scheme, I'd say. One might even say an act of drunken desperation. Perhaps if I were Jaime. Oh, but Jaime killed her father. I only killed my own. You think Daenerys will execute me and pardon you? But the reverse is just as likely. Maybe you should hop on that pig, Ser Jorah. Put on a suit of iron motley, like Florian the—" The blow the big knight gave him cracked his head around and knocked him sideways, so hard that his head bounced off the deck. Blood filled his mouth as he staggered back onto one knee. He spat out a broken tooth. "Growing prettier every day, but I do believe I poked a wound." "Did the dwarf say something to offend you, sir?" Tyrion asked innocently, wiping bubbles of blood off his broken lip with the back of his hand. "I am sick of your mouth, dwarf," said Mormont. "You still have a few teeth left. If you want to keep them, stay away from me for the rest of this voyage."
"That could be difficult. We share a cabin."
"You can find somewhere else to sleep. Down in the hold, up on deck, it makes no matter. Just keep out of my sight." Tyrion pulled himself back to his feet. "As you wish," he answered, through a mouthful of blood. But the big knight was already gone, his boots pounding on the deck boards. Below in the galley, Tyrion was rinsing out his mouth with rum and water and wincing at the sting when Penny found him.
"I heard what happened. Oh, are you hurt?"
He shrugged. "A bit of blood and a broken tooth. But I believe I hurt him more. And him a knight. Sad to say, I would not count on Ser Jorah should we need protection."
"What did you do? Oh, your lip is bleeding."
She slipped a square from her sleeve and dabbed it.
"What did you say?"
"A few truths, Sir Bezor did not care to hear."
"You mustn't mock him. Don't you know anything? You can't talk that way to big persons. They can hurt you. Ser Jorah could have tossed you in the sea. The sailors would have laughed to see you drown. You have to be careful around big people. Be jolly and playful with them. Keep them smiling. Make them laugh. That's what my father always said. Didn't your father ever tell you how to act with big people?" "My father called them small folk," said Tyrion, "and he was not what you'd call a jolly man." He took another sip of watered rum, slushed it around his mouth, spat it out. "Still, I take your point. I have a deal to learn about being a dwarf. Perhaps you will be good enough to teach me between the jousting and the pig riding." "I will, my lord, gladly. But what were these truths? Why did Ser Jorah hit you so hard?"
"Why, for love. The same reason that I stewed that singer." He thought of Shay, and the look in her eyes as he tightened the chain about her throat, twisting it in his fist. A chain of golden hands. "For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm. Are you a maid, Penny?" She blushed.
"Yes, of course. Who would have stayed that way? Love is madness, and lust is poison. Keep your maidenhead. You'll be happier for it, and you're less like to find yourself in some dingy brothel on the Roine with a whore who looks a bit like your lost love, or chasing across half the world, hoping to find wherever whores go. Ser Jorah dreams of rescuing his dragon queen and basking in her gratitude. But I know a thing or two about the gratitude of kings, and I'd sooner have a palace in Valyria." He broke off suddenly. "Did you feel that? The ship moved." "It did." Penny's face lit up with joy. "We're moving again. The wind." She rushed to the door. "I want to see. Come, I'll race you up." Off she went. "She is young," Tyrion had to remind himself, as Penny scrambled from the galley and up the steep wooden steps as fast as her short legs would allow. "Almost a child." Still, it tickled him to see her excitement. He followed her topside. The sail had come to life again, billowing, emptying, then billowing again, the red stripes on the canvas wriggling like snakes. Sailors dashed across the decks and hauled on lines as the mates bellowed orders in the tongue of old Volantis. The rowers in the ship's boats had loosed their tow ropes and turned back toward the cog, stroking hard. The wind was blowing from the west, swirling and gusting, clutching at ropes and cloaks like a mischievous child. The Selasoria Coran was underway. "Might be we'll make marine after all," Tyrion thought. But when he clambered up the ladder to the stern castle and looked off from the stern, his smile faltered. "Blue sky and blue sea here, but off west I've never seen a sky that colour." A thick band of clouds ran along the horizon. "A bar sinister," he said to Penny, pointing. "What does that mean?" she asked. "It means some big bastard is creeping up behind us." He was surprised to find that Macoro and two of his fiery fingers had joined them on the stern castle. It was only midday, and the Red Priest and his men did not normally emerge till dusk. The priest gave him a solemn nod.
"There you see it, Hugahil, God's wrath. The Lord of Light will not be mocked."
Tyrion had a bad feeling about this. "The widow said this ship would never reach her destination. I took that to mean that once we were out to sea, beyond the reach of Triarchs, the captain would change course for Merin. Or perhaps that you would seize the ship with your fiery hand and take us to Daenerys. But that isn't what your high priest saw at all, is it?"
"No."
Makoro's deep voice tolled as solemnly as a funeral bell.
"This is what he saw."
The Red Priest lifted his staff and inclined its head toward the west. Penny was lost.
"I don't understand. What does it mean?"
"It means we'd best get below. Ser Jorah has exiled me from our cabin. Might I hide in yours when the time comes?"
"Yes," she said. "You would be... oh."
For the better part of 3 hours they ran before the wind as the storm grew closer. the western sky went green, then grey, then black. A wall of dark clouds loomed up behind them, churning like a kettle of milk left on the fire too long. Tyrion and Penny watched from the forecastle, huddled by the figurehead and holding hands, careful to stay out of the way of captain and crew. The last storm had been thrilling, intoxicating, a sudden squall that had left him feeling cleansed and refreshed. This one felt different, right from the first. The captain sensed it too. He changed their course to north by northeast to try and get out of the storm's path. It was a futile effort. This storm was too big. The seas around them grew rougher. The wind began to howl. The stinky Stuart rose and fell as waves smashed against her hull. Behind them, lightning stabbed down from the sky, blinding purple bolts that danced across the sea in webs of light. Thunder followed. "The time has come to aid." Tyrion took Penny by the arm and led her below decks. Pretty and Crunch were both half mad with fear. The dog was barking, barking, barking. He knocked Tyrion right off his feet as they entered. The sow had been shitting everywhere. Tyrion cleaned it up as best he could, whilst Penny tried to calm the animals. Then they tied down or put away anything that was still loose. "I'm frightened," Penny confessed. The cabin had begun to tilt and jump, going this way and that, as the waves hammered at the hull of the ship. "There are worse ways to die than drowning. Your brother learned that, and so did my lord father. And Shay, that lying cunt. Hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm." "We should play a game," Tyrion suggested. "That might help take our thoughts off the storm." "Not Syvas," she said at once. "Not Syvas," Tyrion agreed, as the deck rose under him. That would only lead to pieces flying violently across the cabin and raining down on sow and dog. "When you were a little girl, did you ever play Come Into My Castle?" "No. Can you teach me?" "Could he?" Tyrion hesitated. "Fool of a dwarf. Of course she's never played Come Into My Castle. She never had a castle." Come Into My Castle was a game for high-born children, one meant to teach them courtesy, heraldry, and a thing or two about their lord father's friends and foes. "That won't," he started. The deck gave another violent heave, slamming the two of them together. Penny gave a squeak of fright. "That game won't do," Tyrion told her, gritting his teeth. "Sorry, I don't know what game..." "I do." Penny kissed him. It was an awkward kiss, rushed, clumsy, but it took him utterly by surprise. His hands jerked up and grabbed hold of her shoulders to shove her away. Instead, he hesitated, then pulled her closer, gave her a squeeze. Her lips were dry, hard, closed up tighter than a miser's purse. "A small mercy," thought Tyrion. This was nothing he had wanted. He liked Penny. He pitied Penny. He even admired Penny in a way. But he did not desire her. He had no wish to hurt her, though. The gods and his sweet sister had given her enough pain. So he let the kiss go on, holding her gently by the shoulders. His own lips stayed firmly shut. The Selasauri Corran rolled and shuddered around them. Finally, she pulled back an inch or two. Tyrion could see his own reflection shining in her eyes. "Pretty eyes," he thought, but he saw other things as well. A lot of fear, a little hope, but not a bit of lust. She does not want me, no more than I want her. When she lowered her head, he took her under the chin and raised it up again. "We cannot play that game, my lady." Above, the thunder boomed, close at hand now. I never kissed a boy before, but I only thought, what if we drown and I...
It was sweet, lied Tyrion.
But I am married. She was with me at the feast. You may remember her, Lady Sansa.
Was she your wife? She was very beautiful.
And false. Sansa, Shay, all my women. Tysha was the only one who ever loved me. Where do whores go?
A lovely girl, said Tyrion,
and we were joined beneath the eyes of gods and men. It may be that she is lost to me, but until I know that for a certainty, I must be true to her.
I understand. Penny turned her face away from his.
My perfect woman, Tyrion thought bitterly, one still young enough to believe such blatant lies. The hull was creaking, the deck moving, and Pretty was squealing in distress. Penny crawled across the cabin floor on her hands and knees, wrapped her arms around the Tsar's head, and murmured reassurance to her. Looking at the two of them, it was hard to know who was comforting whom. The sight was so grotesque, it should have been hilarious, but Tyrion could not even find a smile. The girl deserves better than a pig, he thought. An honest kiss, a little kindness, everyone deserves that much, however big or small. He looked about for his wine cup, but when he found it, all the rum had spilled. Drowning is bad enough, he reflected sourly, but drowning sad and sober, that's too cruel. In the end, they did not drown, though there were times when the prospect of a nice, peaceful drowning had a certain appeal. The storm raged for the rest of that day and well into the night. Wet winds howled around them, and waves rose up like the fists of drowned giants to smash down on their decks. Above, they learned later, a mate and two sailors were swept overboard. The ship's cook was blinded when a kettle of hot grease flew up into his face, and the captain was thrown from the stern castle to the main deck so violently he broke both legs. Below, Crunch howled and barked and snapped at Penny, and Pretty Pig began to shit again, turning the cramped, damp cabin into a sty. Tyrion managed to avoid retching his way through all of this, chiefly thanks to the lack of wine. Penny was not so fortunate, but he held her anyway as the ship's hull creaked and groaned alarmingly around them, like a cask about to burst. Near by midnight, the winds finally died away, and the sea grew calm enough for Tyrion to make his way back up onto deck. What he saw there did not reassure him. The cog was drifting on a sea of dragonglass beneath a bowl of stars, but all around the storm raged on. East, west, north, south, everywhere he looked, the clouds rose up like black mountains, their tumbled slopes and colossal cliffs alive with blue and purple lightning. No rain was falling, but the decks were slick and wet underfoot. Tyrion could hear someone screaming from below, a thin, high voice hysterical with fear. He could hear Macaro too. The Red Priest stood on the forecastle facing the storm, his staff raised above his head as he boomed a prayer. Amidships, a dozen sailors and two of the fiery fingers were struggling with tangled lines and sodden canvas. But whether they were trying to raise the sail again or pull it down, he never knew. Whatever they were doing, it seemed to him a very bad idea. And so it was. The wind returned as a whispered threat, cold and damp, brushing over his cheek, flapping the wet sail, swirling and tugging at Macaro's scarlet robes. Some instinct made Tyrion grab hold of the nearest rail just in time. In the space of three heartbeats, the little breeze became a howling gale. Macaro shouted something, and green flames leapt from the dragon's maw atop his staff to vanish in the night. Then the rains came, black and blinding, and forecastle and stern castle both vanished behind a wall of water. Something huge flapped overhead,
and Tyrion glanced up in time to see the sail taking wing, with two men still dangling from the lines. Then he heard a crack. Oh, bloody hell! He had time to think. That had to be the mast. He found a line and pulled on it, fighting towards the hatch to get himself below out of the storm. But a gust of wind knocked his feet from under him, and a second slammed him into the rail, and there he clung. Rain lashed at his face, blinding him. His mouth was full of blood again. The ship groaned and growled beneath him, like a constipated fat man straining to shit. Then the mast burst. Tyrion never saw it, but he heard it. That cracking sound again, and then a scream of tortured wood, and suddenly the air was full of shards and splinters. One missed his eye by half an inch, a second found his neck, a third went through his calf, boots and breeches and all. He screamed, but he held on to the line, held on with a desperate strength he did not know he had. The widow said the ship would never reach her destination, he remembered. Then he laughed and laughed, wild and hysterical, as thunder boomed and timbers moaned and waves crashed all around him. By the time the storm abated and the surviving passengers and crew came crawling back on deck like pale pink worms wriggling to the surface after a rain, the Selasauricoran was a broken thing, floating low in the water and listing 10 degrees to port, her hull sprung in 50 places, her hold awash in seawater, her mast a splintered ruin no taller than a dwarf. Even her figurehead had not escaped. One of his arms had broken off, the one with all his scrolls. 9 men had been lost, including a mate, 2 of the Fiery Fingers, and Makaro himself. Did Benero see this in his fires? Tyrion wondered when he realized that huge red priest was gone. Did Makaro? Prophecy is like a half-trained mule, he complained to Jorah Mormont. It looks as though it might be useful, but the moment you trust in it, it kicks you in the head. That bloody widow knew the ship would never reach her destination. She warned us of that. Said Benero saw it in his fires. And I took that to mean, well, what does it matter? His mouth twisted. What it really meant was that some bloody big storm would turn our mast to kindling, so that we could drift aimlessly across the gulf of grief until our food ran out and we started eating one another. Who do you suppose they'll carve up first? The pig, the dog, or me? The noisiest, I'd say. The captain died the following day. The ship's cook 3 nights later. It was all that the remaining crew could do to keep the wreck afloat. The mate, who had assumed command, reckoned they were somewhere off the southern end of the Isle of Cedars. When he lowered the ship's boats to tow them toward the nearest land, one sank, and the men in the other cut the line and rowed off north, abandoning the cog and all their shipmates. Slaves, said Jorah Mormont, contemptuous. The big knight had slept through the storm, to hear him tell it. Tyrion had his doubts, but he kept them to himself. One day he might want to bite someone in the leg, and for that you needed teeth. Mormont seemed content to ignore their disagreement, so Tyrion decided to pretend it had not happened. For 19 days they drifted, as food and water dwindled. The sun beat down on them, relentless. Penny huddled in her cabin with her dog and her pig, and Tyrion brought her food, limping on his bandaged calf and sniffing at the wound by night. When he had nothing else to do, he pricked his toes and fingers too. So Jorah made a point of sharpening his sword each day, honing the point until it gleamed. The 3 remaining Fiery Fingers lit the night fire as the sun went down, but they wore their ornate armor as they led the crew in prayer, and the spears were close at hand. And not a single sailor tried to rub the head of either dwarf.
"Should we joust for them again?" Penny asked one night.
"Best not," said Tyrion. "That would only serve to remind them we have a nice plump pig."
Though pretty, it was growing less plump with every passing day, and crunch was fur and bones. That night he dreamed that he was back in King's Landing again, a crossbow in his hand. "Wherever a horse go," Lord Tywin said. But when Tyrion's finger clenched and the bowstring thrummed, it was Penny with a quarrel buried in her belly. He woke to the sound of shouting. The deck was moving under him, and for half a heartbeat he was so confused he thought he was back on the Shy Maid. A whiff of pig shit brought him to his senses. The sorrows were behind him, half a world away, and the joys of that time as well. He remembered how sweet L'Amour had looked after her morning swims, with beads of water glistening on her naked skin. But the only maiden here was his poor Penny, the stunted little dwarf girl. Something was afoot, though. Tyrion slipped from his hammock, yawning, and looked about for his boots. And mad though it was, he looked for the crossbow as well. But, of course, there was none such to be found. "A pity," he mused. "It might have been some use when the big folk come to eat me." He pulled his boots on and climbed up on deck to see what the shouting was about. Penny was there before him, her eyes wide with wonder.
"A sail!" she shouted. "There, there, do you see? A sail! And they've seen us! They have a sail!"
This time he kissed her, once on each cheek, once on the brow, and one last one on the mouth. She was flushed and laughing by the last kiss, suddenly shy again, but it made no matter. The other ship was closing, a big galley he saw. Her oars left a long white wake behind her. "What ship is that?" he asked Sir Jorah Mormont. "Can you read her name?"
"I don't need to read her name. We're downwind. I can smell her." Mormont drew his sword. "That's a slaver."
Elaine. She turned the iron ring and pushed the door open just a crack. "Sweet Robin," she called. "May I enter?"
"Have a care, my lady," warned old Gretchel, wringing her hands. "His lordship threw his chamber pot at the maester."
"Then he has none to throw at me. Isn't there some work you should be doing? And you, Maddie? Are all the windows closed and shuttered? Have all the furnishings been covered?"
"All of them, my lady," said Maddie.
"Best make certain of it." Elaine slipped into the darkened bedchamber. "It's only me, sweet Robin." Someone sniffled in the darkness.
"Are you alone?"
"I am, my lord." "Come close, then. Just you." Elaine shut the door firmly behind her. It was solid oak, 4 inches thick. Maddie and Gretchel might listen all they wished, but they would hear nothing. That was just as well. Gretchel could hold her tongue, but Maddie gossiped shamelessly.
"Did Maester Coleman send you?"
the boy asked.
"No,"
she lied. "I heard my sweet Robin was ailing." After his encounter with the chamber pot, the maester had come running to Sir Lothar, and Brune had come to her.
"If my lady can talk him out of bed nice," the knight said, "I won't have to drag him out."
"We can't have that," she told herself. When Robert was handled roughly, he was apt to go into a shaking fit. "Are you hungry, my lord?" she asked the little lord. "Shall I send Maddie down for berries and cream, or some warm bread and butter?" Too late, she remembered that there was no warm bread. The kitchens were closed, the oven cold. "If it gets Robert out of bed, it would be worth the bother of lighting a fire," she told herself. "I don't want food," the little lord said in a reedy, petulant voice. "I'm going to stay in bed today. You could read to me if you want." "It is too dark in here for reading." The heavy curtains drawn across the windows made the bedchamber black as night. "Has my sweet Robin forgotten what day this is?"
"No,"
he said, "but I'm not going. I want to stay in bed."
you could read to me about the Winged Knight. The Winged Knight was Sir Artis Arryn. Legend said that he had driven the first men from the Vale and flown to the top of the Giant's Lance on a huge falcon to slay the Griffin King. There were 100 tales of his adventures. Little Robert knew them all so well he could have recited them from memory, but he liked to have them read to him all the same. "Sweetling, we have to go," she told the boy, "but I promise I'll read you 2 tales of the Winged Knight when we reach the Gates of the Moon." "3," he said at once. No matter what you offered him, Robert always wanted more. "3," she agreed. "Might I let some sun in?" "No, the light hurts my eyes. Come to bed, Elaine." She went to the windows anyway, edging around the broken chamber pot. She could smell it better than she saw it. "I shan't open them very wide. Only enough to see my sweet Robin's face." He sniffed. "If you must." The curtains were of plush blue velvet. She pulled one back a finger's length and tied it off. Dust motes danced in a shaft of pale morning light. The small diamond-shaped panes of the window were obscured by frost. Elaine rubbed at one with the heel of her hand, enough to glimpse a brilliant blue sky and a blaze of white from the mountainside. The eyrie was wrapped in an icy mantle, the Giant's Lance above buried in waist-deep snows. When she turned back, Robert Arryn was propped up against the pillows, looking at her. The Lord of the Eyrie and Defender of the Vale. A woolen blanket covered him below the waist. Above it he was naked, a pasty boy with hair as long as any girl's. Robert had spindly arms and legs, a soft concave chest and little belly, and eyes that were always red and runny. He cannot help the way he is. He was born small and sickly. "You look very strong this morning, my lord." He loved to be told how strong he was. "Shall I have Maddie and Gretchel fetch hot water for your bath? Maddie will scrub your back for you and wash your hair to make you clean and lordly for your journey. Won't that be nice?" "No, I hate Maddie. She has a wart on her eye, and she scrubs so hard it hurts. My mummy never hurt me scrubbing." "I will tell Maddie not to scrub my sweet Robin so hard. You'll feel better when you're fresh and clean." "No bath, I told you! My head hurts most awfully. Shall I bring you a warm cloth for your brow, or a cup of dream wine? Only a little one, though. Maya Stone is waiting down at Sky, and she'll be hurt if you go to sleep on her. You know how much she loves you." "I don't love her. She's just the mule girl," Robert sniffled. "Maester Coleman put something vile in my milk last night. I could taste it. I told him I wanted sweet milk, but he wouldn't bring me any, not even when I commanded him. I am the Lord. He should do what I say. No one does what I say." "I'll speak to him," Elaine promised, "but only if you get up out of bed. It's beautiful outside, sweet Robin. The sun is shining bright, a perfect day for going down the mountain. The mules are waiting down at Sky with Maya." His mouth quivered. "I hate those smelly mules. One tried to bite me once. You tell that Maya that I'm staying here." He sounded as if he were about to cry. "No one can hurt me so long as I stay here. The eyrie is impregnable. Who would want to hurt my sweet Robin? Your lords and knights adore you, and the small folk cheer your name." "He is afraid," she thought, "and with good reason." Since his lady mother had fallen, the boy would not even stand upon a balcony, and the way from the eyrie to the Gates of the Moon was perilous enough to daunt anyone. Elaine's heart had been in her throat when she made her own ascent with Lady Lysa and Lord Peter, and everyone agreed that the descent was even more harrowing, since you were looking down the whole time. Maya could tell of great lords and bold knights who had gone pale and wet their small clothes on the mountain, and none of them had the shaking sickness either. Still, it would not serve. On the valley floor, autumn still lingered, warm and golden, but winter had closed around the mountain peaks. They had weathered 3 snowstorms and an ice storm that transformed the castle into crystal for a fortnight. The eyrie might be impregnable, but it would soon be inaccessible as well, and the way down grew more hazardous every day. Most of the castle servants and soldiers had already made the descent. Only 12 still lingered up here to attend Lord Robert. "Sweet Robin," she said gently, The descent will be ever so jolly, you'll see. Sir Lothar will be with us, and Maya. Her mules have gone up and down this old mountain 1,000 times. "I hate mules," he insisted. "Mules are nasty.